Now
on News Talk 105.9 WMAL.
The Saturday Morning Update.
Good morning. It is the Saturday Morning Update. I'm Rick Fowler. Jeff Wolf behind the console. Jane Houghton and our producer this morning. And we have hit yet another all-time record for gasoline prices. We're up over $5 a gallon for the national average, and it's not going to get any better. The projections are that it will continue to go higher throughout the summer. The economy is a mess, and anybody that would try and tell you differently, I don't know how they can, but they are trying. Let's give you some stats first, and then we'll get into the splaining from the administration. These numbers are from CNN this morning. Now, on CNN, they reported this morning that inflation, 8.6%, the fastest since 1981. Airfares are up 37.8%, the highest since 1980. Groceries are up 11.9%, the highest since 1979. Rent up 5.2%, highest since 1987. And fuel is up 106%, the highest ever. But here's how President Biden explains it this week.
My plans are to produce the strongest, fastest, most widespread economic recovery America has ever experienced, with record jobs, new record small businesses, and wages rising.
What? Wages rising? And it's all being eaten alive? The minute you get a raise, it's gone? I mean, you're net negative even if you do get a raise. So here's Corinne Jean-Pierre explaining it at the White House podium.
The economy is in a better place than it has been historically. We are in a good position to really start really working on lowering prices. We leave that piece to the Federal Reserve.
Okay, two things in there. I'm going to play this again. It's the best ever historically. What did she say in the beginning of this thing? And then who's responsible? Federal Reserve. It's not on us. We're not going to take the blame on this. If it all goes down the toilet, it's on the Federal Reserve. Play this one again.
The economy is in a better place than it has been historically. We are in a good position to really start really working on lowering prices. We leave that piece to the Federal Reserve.
Okay, so it's all up to the Federal Reserve. We've seen what geniuses they've been. Janet Yellen is our Secretary of the Treasury. Now, you heard the numbers I just gave you, and you've probably noticed when you filled up the tank. I filled up a car the other day and it was $93. That was fun. And I drove out Connecticut Avenue and drove out early in the morning and it was $5.05 a gallon. And when I drove back in the afternoon, came back down Connecticut Avenue, it was $5.09 a gallon. So it went up 4 cents in about 12 hours during the day this week. So Secretary of the Treasury can't understand why we're pessimistic.
When you look at opinion polls and you see what households have to say, it's amazing how pessimistic they are, given that we have about the strongest labor market we've had in the entire post-war period. People can easily find jobs.
You can easily find a job, but you have to make like $59,000 a month to survive these days. I mean, what is she thinking? These people are so out of touch. How out of touch are they? One of our members on Capitol Hill, Debbie Stabenow, she drives back from Michigan, okay? Now, the median income in Michigan is something around $35,000. I mean, they don't make a lot of money in the state of Michigan. But here's how she describes her journey back from Michigan.
On the issue of gas prices, after waiting for a long time to have enough chips in this country to finally get my electric vehicle, I got it and drove it from Michigan to here this last weekend and went by every single gas station. It didn't matter how high it was.
Oh, it didn't matter how high it was to you, Debbie Stabenow. But how about to your constituency? How about to the rest of us that haven't gotten an electric vehicle yet? You know, when you drive around town and you see people who have a car that may be 15, 20 years old, and, you know, sometimes the color of the door doesn't match the color of the fender because they were in an accident, they had to have it replaced, but they can't afford to have the car repainted. Now, how many of them are going to go out and get an electric vehicle at an average price of $65,000? And for that person who is driving that car that can't afford to get the car repainted, how are they possibly affording what is going on with gasoline and with food prices? These are people that probably work in D.C., but they live in the suburbs and probably quite a ways out in the suburbs because they can't afford to live in D.C., but they have to drive in here so they can find work. How are these people surviving? But Debbie Stabenow had a great trip in and just drove past those gas stations and didn't even have to look at the prices. Well, Kevin McCarthy, of course, the minority leader in the House, he sort of puts it in a little more perspective and kind of contrasting it here with the January 6th hearings of Thursday night.
I don't see any primetime hearings set for gas price, for battling inflation, for feeding our children, for making the streets safer.
So, that's Kevin McCarthy. So, January 6th, all right, the hearings. And I'm not going to spend a lot of time on it. You'll formulate your own impressions. You think about some of the people that are running the hearings. Adam Schiff, who lied for 3 years about the Trump-Russia collusion, continually and repeatedly lied to the American public. We're really going to trust that Adam Schiff is going to make a real, equitable, and fair presentation and really get to the facts. Really get to the facts. And Benny Thompson, my understanding is Benny called for Trump to be impeached between the time he was elected and before Trump was inaugurated. He was calling for the impeachment of President Trump before he got in office. So these are the folks running the January 6th hearings. We would have had Jim Banks on the committee. He's a congressman, Republican congressman. Congressman Banks would have been on the committee, but the Speaker of the House wouldn't allow him on the committee. So who do you have? You have Liz Cheney and Adam Kinzinger, two quote-unquote Republicans, the two Republicans in the House that most loathe Donald Trump. But they're on the committee. Jim Banks wasn't on the committee. And here's what Jim Banks had to say the morning after.
Well, last night's hearing was a primetime dud. Nothing came out of it that we didn't know before, and it didn't change anybody's minds. At the end of the day, this committee is trying to prosecute Donald Trump for crimes that he did not commit. And last night proved that they don't have any evidence that shows anything that's different than that. They want to throw Donald Trump in jail. If they can't get that done, they want to prevent his name from appearing on the ballot. They want to continue to use this committee process as a way to attack their political opponents. But we also learned from reports over the weekend that this committee is actually going to come out and recommend for abolishing the Electoral College and to advance the radical election agenda of the Democrats to nationalize, federalize elections to move all states toward mail-in ballots. That's what this committee is really all about. It's not about investigating January 6th.
Here's another interesting note. There's a Pennsylvania Republican congressman, Scott Perry. Now, Liz Cheney, the vice chair of the select committee, said that Perry was involved in efforts to get a Justice Department lawyer, Jeff Clark, appointed as attorney general, and accused Perry of seeking a pardon. Okay? Well, Perry challenged the allegation made by Liz Cheney during the Thursday night hearing. And here's what Perry wrote on Twitter on Friday. Quote, "The notion that I ever sought a presidential pardon for myself or other members of Congress is an absolute, shameless, and soulless lie." He wrote that on Twitter on Friday. Now, you'd think that if he wrote that on Twitter, he's probably pretty confident because he's, I'm sure, been surveyed, and they've got every email or text that he's ever written in his entire life probably at the committee's beckon. So if he said that, I would imagine he's pretty confident that he never did ask for a pardon. So there's a potentially false allegation alone right there from the committee. Everybody was running around in the mainstream media. Oh, 19 million viewers. We had 19 million viewers. MSNBC, great ratings, beat Fox. Well, to put it in perspective, they say 19 million viewers. NBC's Sunday Night Football The most watched show of the season had 18 million total viewers. That's the most watched weekly show. 18 million total viewers for Sunday Night Football. That's one network, Sunday Night Football, about the same numbers that they had combined for the hearings, ABC, CBS, NBC, Fox Business Channel, CNN, MSNBC, all of them. So, one other note. To contrast it with the Super Bowl, they had 19 million viewers for the hearings. The most recent Super Bowl, 112 million viewers. So 19 million, not that big a number in the big picture. And Senator John Kennedy always has the ability to put things in perspective. And here's his reaction to the January 6th hearings.
I'm not saying that what happened on January 6th wasn't repugnant. It was. If you look up the word repugnant in the dictionary, there's a picture of January 6th. I don't know a single American who's proud of what happened that day. And the people who broke into our Capitol are being seriously punished, and they should be. Now, if Speaker Pelosi, and Speaker Pelosi is the House, wants to conduct an investigation, that's her business. I think she would have been better served if she had allowed the Republican minority to nominate their own members, so we would have had more of a balanced playing field. I think it would have given the investigation more credibility. I understand now that she's going to hold primetime hearings. They're going to be produced by a former major television executive.
Yes.
I'm sure they're going to try to make it look like CSI Miami so that the ratings will be high. That's their business, but I'm telling you that what I think people are worried about when they lie down to sleep at night and can't.
That's Senator John Kennedy. We're at 6:21 Saturday morning update. Albie D is in the WMAL Traffic Center.
In Virginia, on the inner loop of the Beltway in McLean, there is a crash. Right lane is blocked near Georgetown Pike. In Arlington, on 66 eastbound, there is an accident. Right lane is blocked at Sycamore Street. In Prince George's County on the ICC eastbound at 95, there is a crash. Left merge lane is closed there. And on the Maryland side of the Beltway, you shouldn't find any delays in Prince George's County or in Montgomery County on the inner loop or on the outer loop. And now from GarageDoorRepair.com, the WMAL Stormwatch 7 forecast.
Scattered showers this morning to start the day. I think we'll have some dry hours this afternoon. High temperatures in the mid to upper 70s. Also have the chance for a few isolated storms later on this afternoon and evening, mainly south of town. Lows back in the 60s tonight. We'll get into the mid 80s on your Sunday. Scattered showers and storms possible. Some may be strong to severe by the afternoon. I'm 7 News meteorologist Alex Liggett in the Stormwatch 7 Weather Center.
66 degrees in the nation's capital, 6:22 on the Saturday morning update.
News Talk 105.9 WMAL.
Making sense of the news.
It's a hard thing to do these days. It is 6:22. It is the Saturday morning update. I'm Rick Fowler. Thank you for being with us this morning. We've heard, well, I'm not so sure we've all heard about this because the story's been buried. It was on A21 in the New York Times. I think a later edition of the New York Times put it up on A10. And, of course, this was the arrest of a young man who came in from Simi Valley, California. He was armed with a pistol and crowbar that he had planned an attack on Brett Kavanaugh. And he was out in front of Brett Kavanaugh's house early Wednesday morning and saw the U.S. Marshals and called and asked for psychiatric help, charged with attempted murder. So we'll talk with Jim Trusty about that this morning, get a little more on the charges and the overall significance of what this means. There is a federal statute that says it is forbidden by federal law to protest with the intent of intimidating Supreme Court justices. That law is not being enforced, and I just mentioned that the potential attack on Kavanaugh would have happened Wednesday morning, and it was about like 1 a.m. in the morning. Well, later that morning, the protesters were back, and of course, our Department of Justice and our Attorney General doing nothing to enforce a federal statute about intimidating Supreme Court justices. Nice work. But then when you have the Senate Majority Leader, we'll take you back to the spring of 2020, classic lines from Chuck Schumer, outside the Supreme Court, I really get worked up when I listen to this. But what these guys are doing and saying about our Supreme Court, and this is the Senate Majority Leader.
I want to tell you, Gorsuch, I want to tell you, Kavanaugh, you have released the whirlwind, and you will pay the price. You won't know what hit you if you go forward with these awful decisions.
You won't know what hit you. The Senate Majority Leader says that to Supreme Court justices and names them. And you've heard it. I know you've heard it, but I cannot understand how these people think. Well, Marco Rubio and Senator Kennedy had some thoughts on the Kavanaugh incident.
There's only one reason for protesters to show up outside the home of a public figure, and that is to send them a clear message. We know where you live.
Not Nancy Pelosi, who said, the Speaker of the House, I'm perfectly okay with people going to a justice's home to try to intimidate the court to change the ruling on Roe v. Wade. So this is a logical extension to their behavior.
When you send that kind of message, it just undermines the legitimacy of the United States Supreme Court as an institution. And this is what it leads to.
So you think, just to be clear, you think some of Democrats' rhetoric is to blame for what happened this morning?
Well, of course.
Speaker Pelosi addressed a question. You know, there's some legislation that would increase security for the Supreme Court justices, but it is stalled on Capitol Hill, and she was asked about that.
The justices are protected. You saw the attorney general even double down on that.
But this is about security for the justices. An armed man showed up near Justice Kavanaugh's house to try to...
We're working together on the bill that the Senate will be able to approve of. There will be a bill, but nobody is in danger over the weekend because of our not having a bill.
But nobody's in danger over the weekend. I'm glad she's so confident about that, Madam Speaker, the one that protected Capitol Hill on January 6th, which was her responsibility. 626, it is the Saturday morning update on WMAL. We'll be talking with Jim Trusty coming up later this morning. We've also got Jennifer Harper on the way. John Gizzi will be with us. Contrast to the Watergate hearings and how those were handled versus how January 6th hearings are being handled. Also coming up this morning, we will talk with Lieutenant Colonel Tony Schaefer and K.T. McFarland. We'll put it all in perspective for us.
News Talk 105.9 WMAL.
Making sense of the news.
In the news at 6:30, tens of thousands of people are expected at rallies this weekend here in Washington and around the U.S. demanding that Congress pass changes to gun laws. The second March for Our Lives rally will take place in front of the Washington Monument today, a successor to the 2018 March. President Biden says Ukrainian President Zelensky, quote, didn't want to hear it when U.S. intelligence gathered information that Russia was preparing to invade. Speaking to donors at a Democratic fundraiser in L.A., the president made the remarks as he talked about the work to rally support for Ukraine as the war continues into its fourth month. President Zelensky has been addressing a summit of Asian leaders today. And in Chicago, a report that the Cook County State's Attorney, Kim Fox, was involved in a domestic abuse situation at her home. Her husband called police and reported a domestic incident with his wife, the Cook County State's Attorney. He told responding officers she became angry with him about something he posted on Facebook and ultimately slapped him in the face. 6:31, it's the Saturday morning update on WMAL. Al BD is in the WMAL Traffic Center.
In Fairfax County on 66 eastbound, there is a crash. Right lane is blocked in Arlington at Sycamore Street. Now on the Beltway in Virginia, Inner Loop in McLean, right lane is blocked for an accident near Georgetown Pike. In D.C., 395 southbound at the 3rd Street Tunnel, there's a crash there. And on the ICC in Calverton, I have a report of a crash at 95 exit 19. And now from GarageDoorRepair.com, the WMAL Stormwatch 7 forecast.
Scattered showers this morning to start the day. I think we'll have some dry hours this afternoon. High temperatures in the mid to upper 70s. Also have the chance for a few isolated storms later on this afternoon and evening, mainly south of town. Lows back in the 60s tonight. We'll get into the mid 80s on your Sunday. Scattered showers and storms possible. Some may be strong to severe by the afternoon. I'm 7 News meteorologist Alex Liggett in the Stormwatch 7 Weather Center.
66 degrees in the nation's capital. 6:32, the Saturday morning update.
Headlines, analysis, perspective.
News Talk 105.9 WMAL.
Making sense of the news.
The Saturday morning update continues. We are always happy to have Jennifer Harper join us. She writes Inside the Beltway at the Washington Times. Good morning.
Good morning, Rick.
When you go to the grocery store, you go to the gas station, you see the problems that are facing the American people and obviously facing the administration. And one GOP analyst is putting it an interesting way.
Yes, indeed. My goodness. You know, we've had stocks dropping by 600 points, inflation up by 8.6%. I mean, the whole nine yards. And you would expect right now that the Biden administration would maybe make a couple of nice appearances in the friendly media and reassure the American public and so forth and so on. But obviously that's not going on, particularly. And, there is a very interesting publication called the New Hampshire Journal, which I always like to read because it's not necessarily down home, but it's very clever sometimes. And, they weighed in on all of this. And according to Michael Graham, he is the managing editor of the New Hampshire Journal. He says, the Democrats, their president is the most unpopular in the history of modern polling. Gas prices on their watch are about to hit $5 a gallon. Well, they've gone over that. Keep rising. Inflation is higher than it has been in 40 years, and shoppers are being forced to cut back on basics. And then he goes on to point out the southern border, the record numbers of undocumented immigrants coming in. And even on the northern border, he points out that some moms are driving to Canada to get their baby formula. Crime is rising. He says parents are fleeing the public schools. COVID is still infecting thousands every day. And then there's Afghanistan, China, Iran, and Russia. He goes through the whole thing. And he characterizes it by saying this: welcome to the Democrats' Thunderdome 2022. And he says, what strikes me this cycle is that the Biden presidency already feels worn out. He's like a second-term president. So that's kind of an interesting little timely update from our friends up there in New Hampshire.
President Biden out this week blaming everybody else for all of his problems on Kimmel. He's blaming the media on Thursday and Friday. He's blaming the cargo shipping companies for the increases in prices there. He's blamed the oil companies for everything. At what point does the blame game stop and he takes on some responsibility here?
Yeah, you're not the only one to be thinking about that. In fact, National Review columnist Jim Garrity, a very smart guy over there, he wrote about just that this week. And you know what he says? No more whining in the White House. There's a thought. He writes, President Biden whines to his aides that everything landed on his desk but the locust. And if it's not one thing, it's the other. It's a shame no one informed him that the job of the president is difficult and that he would be expected to address multiple problems at once before he sought the office. This is coming from Jim Garrity. He says the White House is beset by three major problems simultaneously: a president wallowing in self-pity, an in over its head staff that feels the need to keep the president away from cameras, and the few experienced voices of reasons, like perhaps Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen getting boxed out by the Twitter left. Again, this is our friend Jim Garrity saying this. He says, Joe Biden, you're the president. You asked for this job. You campaigned for this job. You assured us over and over again that you had the right kind of experience and judgment to do this job. You are now in the job that you've been trying to get since 1987. Stop whining about how difficult the job is. So he kind of summarizes the way a lot of people think, I can imagine, at this point.
Normally we talk about presidential polls, but there were three of them out this week that put him at an all-time low. So let's try another poll this week for a change. What are Americans feeling about something that's always been very important to us?
Well, yeah, there's a poll out this week about the Pledge of Allegiance. Pretty interesting. This is coming from YouGov. And they asked people, do you think public schools should require the Pledge of Allegiance to be recited by students each day? And this was conducted June the 2nd among 9,659 U.S. adults. The results are pretty good. They're pretty good. They could be better, but they're pretty good. 52% of Americans agree that the pledge should be part of the daily routine in all schools, and that includes 77% of Republicans, 51% of Independents, and 39% of Democrats, but at least it wasn't like 10% of Democrats. And only 33% said no, the pledge should not be part of the school day, and the rest of them are sort of undecided about the matter. That's only about 15%. And it made me want to find out, Rick, about whether there were, like, lawsuits challenging the Pledge of Allegiance, and my gosh, there certainly are. And I went to a spot called the National Constitution Center, and they offer a very straightforward analysis titled The History of Legal Challenges to the Pledge of Allegiance. If you're curious about that, you can go to constitutioncenter.org. They have all sorts of interesting articles about the pledge, and I found it very interesting reading. And this particular History of Legal Challenges to the Pledge of Allegiance was written by the center's editor-in-chief, which is Scott Amboy, and you can find his article there at that site.
Former President Trump seems to have been in campaign mode over the past few months, and he's got a high-profile event coming up.
Yes, indeed. And let's just term this, Trump is still keeping the faith, and former President Trump is going to be attending the Road to Majority Conference. Now, this is, a lot of people may not have heard of this event, but it's an annual event that is organized by the Faith and Freedom Coalition, and Mr. Trump is, in fact, the keynote speaker for the conference. It is next week, and it has a whole spectrum of conservative heavyweights from the political and cultural realms. And if you haven't heard of this event, it's meant to really raise awareness among conservative voters, get them activated, get them fierce about getting to the polls and so forth and so on. And anyway, here is what they have to say. According to Timothy Head, he's the executive director of the Faith and Freedom Coalition. He says, it is a privilege to welcome former President Donald J. Trump back as speaker for our Road to a Majority Conference for the seventh time. And they say 6 years ago, he began the fight to make America great again. And since the moment, he has delivered some of the most consequential victories for our movement and our nation's victories that continue to inspire leaders in states and communities around the country. So in other words, this is a very faithful group. They also have faith in Donald Trump still. And this is, again, a three-day event. It's going to be in Nashville, Tennessee from June 16 through 18. And they also call Mr. Trump a loyal friend to people of faith. But he's not the only one that is going to be there. This is just a partial list of who is going to this event. This is a very expansive speakers roster here. It includes Senators Marsha Blackburn, Joni Ernst, Lindsey Graham, Bill Hagerty, Rick Scott, and Tim Scott, along with Representatives Dan Crenshaw, Jim Jordan, Barry Loudermilk, Louis Gohmert, Michael Waltz, also along Lieutenant Governor Winsome Sears of Virginia, and Mark Robinson of North Carolina, plus Jeanine Pirro is going to be there, Newt Gingrich, Mike Pompeo, Nikki Haley, and the list really, really does go on and on. But if you're curious about this, go to ffcoalition.com and take a peek.
Jennifer Harper, Inside the Beltway at the Washington Times. As always, thank you so much. We're at 6:43. It is the Saturday morning update on WMAL. Jim Trusty coming up next, but first, Al BD's in the WMAL Traffic Center.
In Anne Arundel County on 32 eastbound, near the Baltimore-Washington Parkway, there is a crash there. In D.C. on 395 southbound at the 3rd Street Tunnel, there is an accident being reported. On the Virginia side of the Beltway, Inner Loop and McLean, traffic is slow because of a crash. Right lane is blocked near Georgetown Pike. And on 66 eastbound in Arlington, you'll find a crash with the right lane blocked at Sycamore Street, exit 69. And now from GarageDoorRepair.com, the WMAL Stormwatch 7 forecast.
Scattered showers this morning to start the day. I think we'll have some dry hours this afternoon. High temperatures in the mid to upper 70s. Also have the chance for a few isolated storms later on this afternoon and evening, mainly south of town. Lows back in the 60s tonight. We'll get into the mid-80s on your Sunday. Scattered showers and storms possible. Some may be strong to severe by the afternoon. I'm 7 News meteorologist Alex Liggett in the Stormwatch 7 Weather Center.
66 degrees at 6:44, the Saturday morning update on WMAL.
News Talk 105.9 WMAL.
Making sense of the news.
It's the Saturday Morning Update. I'm Rick Fowler. Jim Trustee is with us each week. He is a partner at IFRA Law here in Washington, former chief of the Organized Crime and Gang Section at the U.S. Department of Justice. Jim, good morning.
Good morning, Rick.
Nicholas John Roski of Simi Valley, California, carries a gun, ammunition, a knife, pepper spray, a screwdriver, zip ties, and other gear to the home of Supreme Court Justice Brett Kavanaugh early Wednesday morning. He calls 911, 15-minute conversation with 911, and tells the 911 operator he needs psychiatric help. He stood down. Of course, he was arrested. And, Jim, he's been charged with attempted murder. I think a layman would think an attempted murder charge, you know, you throw in a punch or you fire a shot or you, you know, you got a weapon in somebody's face of some sort. Tell us about this charge.
Well, Rick, attempts are interesting, what they call inchoate offenses. And it just means that there's not going to be a perfect bright line that answers your question. But the standard you look at in prosecuting an attempted crime is whether or not the person took what's called a substantial step, or whether their actions reflect what they call mere preparation. Mere preparation is not going to be enough to satisfy a judge or jury that there has been an attempted crime. And conversely, a substantial step is enough. And so in this case, if you're the prosecutor, and this could be a battleground someday at a trial, but if you're a prosecutor, you can point to a lot of things. You can point to the fact that he has pre-armed himself. In other words, he didn't have to scrounge for weapons. In fact, his suitcase full of weaponry and housebreaking materials really seemed to show by itself, you know, premeditation or pre-planning. But he also came from California. He came from across the country to do this, and that is a significant sign. He looked up the address. That's a significant moment. And so I think when you've got a guy who is on the street of the Supreme Court justice, who admittedly was there, you know, by his own admission, to kill the Supreme Court justice, that most jurors are not going to have a hard time with the fact that it's somewhat short from what you described, you know, the actual leveling of a gun or throwing of a punch or pulling out the knife once inside the house. So bottom line is you don't have to get all the way to the house or inside the house for this to be considered a substantial step and therefore an attempted murder.
Well, over the past couple of weeks, Jim, we've heard about a federal statute that prohibits protests intended to intimidate at the home of a Supreme Court justice. The morning after the incident, there were protesters back at Brett Kavanaugh's house. Why is the federal government, i.e. the Justice Department, not enforcing a federal statute, especially when you've got an attempted murder charge in front of a Supreme Court justice's house?
Well, my short answer is because it's Brett Kavanaugh. I mean, I honestly think that this Department of Justice is the most politicized department under Garland's leadership that I've ever seen. And I was around in the department to start off with Janet Reno and Alberto Gonzalez, Holder, Lynch. I mean, I've been through a lot of attorney generals while I was there. And what's going on right now is inexplicable unless you view it through a political lens. And right now, you've got a federal obstruction statute, a misdemeanor, that's directly on point. It basically says you can't go to the house of a judicial official for the purposes of either influencing or intimidating them. And remember, this is all in the context of a leaked opinion where the protesters believe there's still time to change the course of that opinion. So it's on all fours within that statute. The federal prosecutions that could have come from that are being completely shut down. And frankly, as I've said on this show before, Rick, it's not that I think every protester needs to be in jail in segregation or, you know, isolation or something. It's not even that everyone should be prosecuted, but use the law to disperse the illegal assembly. And that's what this is. The DOJ has made a conscious decision through the Attorney General to not enforce the law to allow Kavanaugh's neighbors, Kavanaugh's family, and himself to suffer needlessly with these daily protests. And you know, you look at the Attorney General's reaction to Mr. Roski's attempted assassination, and you pointed out the facts of it. They're pretty egregious. And the Attorney General's response was to say that he, very curious phrasing, that we're not going to tolerate this kind of behavior. And I suppose that sounded tough to him in kind of a Neville Chamberlain way, but to me, I was like, tolerate? What is the issue here that you can't firmly condemn the attempted assassination of a sitting Supreme Court justice? So I'm very concerned that, you know, kind of top down in our current government, that they are creating an atmosphere that's extremely dangerous. It's probably not the same atmosphere we'd see if the protests were taking place at Elena Kagan's or at Justice Sotomayor's. And that's kind of echoed by the president and by the silence of the media. I mean, President Biden could barely bring himself to mention it. And most major media outlets, a traditional mainstream media, couldn't even put it on the front page. And I thought to myself, wow, I mean, if it had been Ruth Bader Ginsburg, Sotomayor, or any other kind of liberal icon on the bench, we would probably have, you know, a day of mourning. But instead, we get a media blackout, an apathetic attorney general, and an ignoring president. And this is a recipe for real disaster when it comes to federal judgeships as a whole, and particularly the Supreme Court safety.
But, Jim, don't forget the southern border is secure, so.
Right. Yeah, we're supposed to take that on faith, I guess.
A lot of talk over the past year about progressive prosecutors around the country as the crime rates spike in major urban areas. San Francisco had about enough of it. It's a heavily Democratic electorate in the city of San Francisco, but they have recalled the DA. And what strikes you about that?
Well, it's a couple of things. I mean, the progressive prosecutors that have popped up around the country have pretty consistently been disasters for the community. And it may well be that when you get down to, you know, even a liberal stronghold like San Francisco, that when they see outrageous, dangerous moments where the community safety is being jeopardized by an ideologue, that even then they say, you know, enough of the politics. We need somebody that's going to make it safe to walk down the street. And what I'm seeing is a real pattern of these progressive prosecutors, and certainly Boudin is Exhibit A on this. But there's some things that may not be all that public that are accompanying these progressive prosecutor offices. And I see a pattern there, and it's a very destructive one. I mean, the first thing is, you know, they're built on a false premise. Most of these progressive prosecutors are not replacing these, you know, lock-them-up-at-all-cost cranky conservative DAs or state attorneys. In fact, many of the people that were replaced by Soros hand-picked, hand-funded prosecutors were already progressive when it came to, you know, coming up with alternatives to jail, such as using drug court, veterans court, teen court, you know, not necessarily locking up everyone for property offenses, but going after the most violent offenders or the most violent offenses in an appropriate way to keep the community safe. So, again, whether you're looking at Chicago, Northern Virginia, San Francisco, Los Angeles, New York, you know, they were not replacing lock-em-up hardcore conservatives. So it starts off with kind of a false dichotomy. The second thing is that these policies that are being generated by progressive prosecutors are at heart very academic or maybe kind of left-wing social justice policies. They're not born on experience. They're not coming from people that have been in the system as prosecutors and see the warts and the problems and the things that need fixing. They're coming from kind of this outside ideologue idea. And when they get in office, and we saw this particularly in Chicago, it creates a brain drain. You know, the experienced prosecutors, Rick, they see this kind of ideology, this misplaced ideology, and they get turned off by it and they leave if they can. And so that compounds the problem because then, you know, guess who the new ideologue Kimberly Fox in Chicago hires? More Kimberly Foxes. Hmm. And so the whole office gets infected with this kind of political nonsense. And then the next thing that I've seen that's probably the most endangering to community safety is these ideologues are driving wedges in the relationships with local law enforcement. And so we had an instance in San Francisco, for instance, where a sheriff's deputy was killed by a gang member. And the sheriff immediately tried to get the case to go federal when normally it would have been a state case. And it was a reflection of his distrust of Boudin, his disbelief that the case would be handled appropriately by state prosecutors. We see this in Philadelphia Los Angeles, San Francisco. And it weaves into another thing, last thing, that's, I think, very interesting about these progressive prosecutors. They bring this kind of warped self-righteousness to the table, and then they become comfortable with a fairly dishonest approach. I mean, they end up believing so strongly that their ends justify the means that they'll say things that are just flat out untrue. The most recent example was Garcon in Los Angeles. There was this case with the young woman and her baby stroller getting mowed down by a young man already on probation for trying to roofie a young woman. And they gave this incredibly soft treatment. And the first thing Garcon did when he was being pushed by the press was to say, well, the Los Angeles Sheriff's Department is in agreement that this was a fair treatment of this young man. The sheriff then points out, we had nothing to do with this case. We had no conversations, and we would never agree that this is a fair treatment. And Garcon basically backpedaled and admitted he had lied about that, you know, vouching from the sheriff's office. So to me, it really is destructive for prosecutors in the long run, but for communities that are suffering through these progressive prosecutors to have dishonest, disingenuous ideologues that think they know better than all the years of experience beneath them and are really kind of poisoning the system on a community level basis.
Jim Trusty, partner at IFRA Law here in Washington. Follow him on Twitter at Trusty Lawyer. Jim, thank you.
All right, thanks. Have a good weekend.
And you too. 6:56, this is the Saturday Morning Update. John Gizzi coming up. We've got an interesting discussion on some legal topics that might apply to you. That's coming up on the way. And also, we've got Lieutenant Colonel Tony Schaefer and K.T. McFarland.
WMAL-FM, Woodbridge, Washington, a Cumulus Media station.
Making sense of the news.
News Talk 105.9.